Hello everyone, welcome to our webinar about hybrid cloud, the best of both worlds. My name is Nadav and I'm part of the cloud enterprise marketing team here at Microsoft. We're really excited to have our guest speaker, Joe Weinman, here today. Joe is a cloud thought leader and author of the book Cloudonomics, the business value of cloud computing, and the forthcoming book, Digital Disciplines. Joe will talk to us today about the benefits of hybrid cloud. And he'll begin in just a moment. Just for reference, if anyone has any questions, you can hit the Q&A widget at the bottom of your screen and type in your questions. If time allows, we'll be able to get to as many questions as we can at the end of the presentation. Also, if you want to download Joe's white paper about hybrid cloud, you can find that in the resource widget at the bottom of your screen. And you can also find some additional hybrid cloud webinars in the resources list. We'll also send out a recording of this webinar and a copy of Joe's slides after the end of this presentation. So Joe, welcome. Really excited to have you here. Why don't we get started?
Thanks very much, Nadav. For everyone on the call, I just took a massive dose of DayQuil, so hopefully I remain alive long enough to get through the call. But what I'd like to do is talk about something that I think is a major debate in the industry, and I have some strong opinions, but I'm going to provide some evidence and quantitative analysis and argument by analogy that will hopefully help you draw your own conclusions. You know, it's really interesting. Some of the math that this is based on, I first wrote about in 2008 and 2009, and people were like, no, Joe, you just don't understand the cloud. I was like, well, I think I do, but, you know, if I made a mistake in the math or the analysis, let me know what the mistake is. And no one ever did. And then now a few years later, the hybrid cloud has, I think, mostly become hot, although, again, it's really interesting if you follow the cloud press, you know, you see articles like hybrid cloud is a desperate attempt by you know, traditional legacy vendors to preserve their hegemony and this, that, and the other thing. So I have a much simpler analysis, which I'd like to take you through. So as Nadav pointed out, I've written a few white papers that kind of are just the sort of logical, business level, quantitative, and architectural concepts. And this hybrid cloud white paper, this presentation will go into a lot more depth, but also as a handy reminder and or useful for sharing, you may want to grab the hybrid cloud white paper or any of the others. So I'd like to start off with a book that was very prescient by Nick Carr, who is a serial best-selling author. He's a super smart guy. And his books are, you know, I would say riveting reading. I wish I could write a tenth as well as he does. And if you haven't seen the book, I'd like to present the argument in it. He argues in The Big Switch that if you go back 150 years or so, people used water wheels and mechanical belts to be able to power their shop equipment to make things like horseshoes and nails and railroad spikes and things like that. And so this wheel, that Burden's water wheel, was possibly tied for the largest, but was certainly the most powerful water wheel ever built. And it was something like 9 stories tall, generated enough power to keep all his factory equipment running. And it was located right next to the factory. So it was sort of the local source of power that drove all of the quote-unquote automated equipment of the time. Now, in 1890-ish, it basically was abandoned because of a breakthrough, or 2 breakthroughs, one of which was Edison's development of an entire system for generating electricity. And then distributing it, and that was direct current. And then Samuel Insull's original exponential growth of alternating current electricity, and the first real sort of hyperscale electric center, if we could call it that, was the Fisk Street Dynamo, and it's a fascinating story in and of itself, and so again, I really recommend you read the book. But of course, this then led to today's dynamos, which we might call the electric cloud, right? They're just enormous. They exhibit huge economies of scale. They have colors like found in some data centers, which is pretty cool. And so if you were to sum up the moral of the big switch, it's basically that this happened in electricity a little over a century ago, moving away from local electricity centers to the electric cloud, and it's going to happen with computing as well, because electricity, you know, sure has some differences, but at this very basic level of analysis, the cloud is just like electricity, and so instead of electricity data centers, we have hyperscale data centers that represent the cloud. And again, because of things like the economies of scale, there's really no point in continuing to run an enterprise data center, and therefore all IT will move to the cloud. Now, that's an interesting argument, and it's a great historical analogy, and the cloud may very well be like electricity, but the problem with that analogy is that electric workloads are actually now moving out of the public electric cloud into private electric clouds. And it goes by the name of distributed power generation, you know, solar energy, whatever you want. But here's an example of a private cloud running multiple workloads like toasters and lights and computer monitors and phone chargers. And the one on the left is wind energy, and the one on the right is solar energy. And the question one might ask is, well, how can that be? Or, you know, what can we learn from that when it comes to computing clouds? So it makes sense to think about what a cloud is, and rather than use the NIST definition, I've developed my own. Which for those of you that are really interested, there's a paper called Axiomatic Cloud Theory that treats this much more mathematically than shown here. But the basic point is that the kind of things that we expect in a cloud, whether it's a private cloud or a public cloud, are, first of all, resources that are not just shared but dynamically allocated across workloads with varying demand levels. Secondly, we don't really care where the user is or where the cloud is, it should still work. The network then becomes critical. And then, although there are lots of cool variations these days, like reserved instances and sustained usage discounts, the point is that pay-per-use pricing turns out to be very critical. And then lastly, elasticity or on-demand resources that scale up and scale down. Now, with this definition, nowhere do you see computer, container, virtualization, Hyper-V, or processor, and so we can use that definition in multiple contexts. So a taxi service dynamically allocates shared resources called taxis across multiple workloads, namely passengers looking for rides. Hotels dynamically allocate shared resources, namely hotel rooms across multiple hotel guests. And even in unusual circumstances, like banks, they have a pool of assets called capital, which they allocate to multiple workloads called personal and business loans, and the pay-per-use rate is just called the interest rate. And when we look at places like that, the first observation we make is that regardless of domain, there is always a private cloud and always a public cloud. For example, for residences, there are homes, and various rooms may get allocated, for example, as you know, one spouse goes into the other room to sleep or a family member shows up. And then, of course, there are classic hotels. And you can look at the relative financial balance there. You know, it varies all over, but if you look, actually, private cloud, which is home ownership, is a majority by two-thirds when averaged over the U.S. compared to public cloud, which might be apartment rentals and or hotels. Another thing we could look at is the private cloud for corporate transportation, also known as the motor pool, and the public cloud, also known as rental car services. And, you know, we can do some comparisons there as well. The rental car market, namely the public cloud market, is huge, $24 billion. But the sales of vehicles for private clouds is $1 trillion. And you could probably subtract out that $24 billion, so maybe it's only $976 billion or whatever, but or $1.75 billion, but you get the point. So when we think about things in this way, simple arguments like economies of scale will drive everyone to the public cloud certainly were true for electricity for a century, don't seem to apply to rental car services. And, you know, you can make different arguments about electricity is different because of that, or homeownership is different because people like to have their own gardens. And so you'd really like a little bit of a more formal, useful framework to figure out which way things will go. So as was mentioned, I did write a book called Cloudonomics a couple of years ago, which is now also available in Chinese. I would love for you to buy millions of copies of the book, but if you don't want to, here are the major quantitative conclusions in one slide. There's a set of formulas, which I don't have time to go into right now, but they basically cover what the benefits are of statistical multiplexing or dynamic pooling of resources into a common pool, which I'll explain a little bit. There are decreasing returns to scale for building out nodes in a content delivery or cloud distributed architecture. Generally, a few dozen is about the sweet spot for human perception and on the planet Earth. And I can sort of address that in a Q&A if necessary. But the key thing is that there are some simple ways to characterize when the pure cloud is better, which it may very well be, and also when hybrids are better or even best. And I'm going to give you some simple tools to understand that. So let's get into hybrid economics. So the first thing is people talk about CapEx versus OpEx, which I think is a very simplistic argument. It actually has no relationship to anything because it isn't simply a matter of the fact that you can either purchase servers from somebody or purchase the ability of those servers to compute from a cloud provider. There are lots more options. So for example, you could easily convert CapEx to OpEx without a cloud provider by simply going to a leasing company and leasing the equipment. And in fact, whenever you have these intermediaries, service providers, banks, leasing companies, et cetera, believe it or not, they're interested in making money off of transactions. And so you're increasingly adding to the cost structure. Now, there may also be benefits like structural scale economies or economies of scope or learning curve effects, but it isn't as simple as economies of scale mean that public cloud providers are automatically less. So the key differences between private and public are, first of all, the fact that you own the capacity or at least can control it. And that's good news and bad news. The bad news is that you have to pay for it whether you're using it or not because the lease payment is fixed. And that's generally an advantage for a public cloud is that it's pay-per-use. Dedicated versus shared capacity also can be beneficial or not depending on your particular application. For example, shared capacity is great for intermittent workloads, but not necessarily optimal if you're trying to architect a particular high-performance architecture that doesn't really match the options available from a public cloud provider. And we can go on and on, but let me go directly to a little bit deeper analysis. It turns out that all you really need to know, and let me sort of footnote that with a all other things being equal, which I'll get into in a second, is first of all, the relative unit cost. In other words, what is a unit or compute of computer storage cost if you do it yourself versus if you have a cloud provider do it? And then the degree of variability and or predictability in your workload. Now, this will take a long time if I go through it, but if you think about the drivers of cost structure, either in an enterprise data center or for a public cloud provider, the obvious one is computing equipment. Now, for a while, cloud providers had some big advantages there because they were using stripped-down server designs, but things like the Open Compute Project have more normalized, I think, the playing field between what's available to enterprises and available to clouds. And so as we keep going through this, there's a number of different items that I'm not going to read to you, but you'll see could be different. Now, that's a long list, but it's only the first slide. So the list goes on, including skill sets and, as I said, not just economies of scale, but learning curve effects, various statistical multiplexing effects, which I'll explain in a second. Then there's switching and search costs to find providers of either equipment or cloud services. There's the fact that generally for a captive IT department, the business units are forced to pay up through transfer prices and internal accounting. That doesn't always happen with outside customers. And so there's a whole set of differences which can certainly vary. But if you were to sum them all up, here's what it looks like. There are these economies of scale type effects and economies of scope and skills and learning and so forth that basically say if you look at the unit cost of a particular item, again, like a virtual server or a gigabyte of storage for a month or whatever the right thing you want to look at is, then yes, a really poorly run enterprise is not going to do as well as the largest cloud service providers that just have all these great things going for them. But that's not the end of the story, because there are other factors that say that, among other things, large cloud service providers, again, like to make a fair profit and generate a return to shareholders. And so they have sales, general, and administrative and additional costs that an enterprise IT shop doesn't have. So if you were to just sort of cut horizontally across here, I'm not sure if you can see my arrow, the point is that a largest cloud provider is almost certainly better than a poorly run enterprise. And again, these aren't to scale, so it might be 2, 10, or 1,000 times better than a really poorly run enterprise. But on the other hand, even with the economies of scale, it isn't immediately obvious that a really well-run enterprise can't achieve very good operational efficiencies compared to the largest cloud provider. I'm not going to claim things one way or another. There's plenty of blog posts out there from very smart people that argue both sides of the equation. And ultimately, what it's going to come down to is you needing to benchmark your own costs and also understand what a public cloud provider would cost. Now, it turns out, though, that the mistake that many people make is if they were to determine that a well-run enterprise, which may very well be your enterprise, has these great efficiencies and is cheaper than the cloud, you might jump to the wrong conclusion, which is that, well, then, if we're cheaper, we shouldn't use the cloud. And the fallacy is the difference between unit cost and total cost. And the problem, as I mentioned earlier, is the notion that you need to pay for capacity whether you're using it or not. So let's say something crazy. Let's assume that a unit of processing costs only a dollar at a well-run enterprise like NBC, but that the cloud is just way overpriced and costs $25,000. Well, it still turns out that it makes sense to use the cloud for workloads like this, which is the Olympics, because there is a something like 25,000 to one peak to average ratio. So it's a lot better to pay more for a little bit of time than to pay less for a lot of time. And this is the reason people use rental cars. Even though a rental car might only cost $10 a day to own and $50 a day to rent, it's cheaper to spend $50 for a day rental than to end up paying tens of thousands of dollars to lease it or own it for several years, but only use it for one day. So every enterprise has its own characteristic pattern. This is a retailer, and you can see the peaks year to year of Cyber Monday and then the period leading up to the holiday shopping deadlines. This is an example of a news site, and you can see various major events which lead to fast-growing spikes with exponential decays. This is a tax preparation firm. You can see early filers, late filers with an immediate drop at midnight on April 15th. And this is kind of the typical startup growth curve, which is exponential. And all of these have different insights as far as using public cloud versus private cloud. Here's the math, and all this says, it looks a little bit complicated, but it really isn't. And you can take a look at either Cloudonomics or a paper I wrote called Mathematical Proof of the Inevitability of Cloud Computing, which basically what this says is that if the cloud costs less than do-it-yourself, then generally it's a good idea to use the cloud. If it costs more, then there are some things that you might want to consider. And in English, here's the way that works. All other things being equal, and I mean security, performance, et cetera, then if cloud services cost less, then you should use them. If cloud services cost more on a unit cost basis, then you would say don't use them, but you'd be wrong. The correct answer is don't jump to conclusions, because it all has to do with the degree of spikiness relative to the degree of costliness. And generally, whenever there's any variation, a hybrid solution turns out to be optimal, again, assuming that there may be at least a modest premium to leveraging cloud services. So this is kind of the way to think of it. Whenever the peak to average ratio is higher than the premium paid for the cloud, it's really costly to do it all yourself, because you've got all of that unused capacity, and that peak to average ratio is high enough that you just can't fill it effectively and make up for even the fact that you can offer or provide those services internally at a lower cost. If you go all public, that's really good, but generally for this particular case of spiky workloads and a slight cloud premium, a hybrid architecture turns out to be provably cost optimal. So here's a handy matrix that I won't spend time on, but it basically relates, you know, cloud less expensive, cloud equal unit cost, cloud more expensive, running along the top to the cloud is not that costly compared to the degree to which the workload is spiky. The cloud is much costlier than the workload is spiky, or the peak to average ratio is one. In other words, the demand is completely flat. Now, it's easy to say all things being equal, but of course there are lots of different potential concerns. Just to give you a sense of a few of them, data gravity, which Dave McCrory coined. The point is that you want to have your processing next to your data because it's very costly to move data around because it has inertia. Now, if your data is already in the enterprise data center, then you may want to keep a lot of your processing there. Conversely, if it's already in the cloud, then you want to keep your processing there because of the cost of network transport. Access to capital and weighted average cost of capital is another. The amount of risk you're willing to take. Obviously, if you're a startup with an unproven product, you may not want to spend $100 million to build a new data center hoping that customers will come. The predictability of your workload, it may be very flat now, but if it's unpredictable, then it may be extremely spiky tomorrow. And so you've got to account for that potential in your relative cost analysis. The other interesting thing is that there are opportunities to self-multiplex workloads, but if they have simultaneous peaks, if they're correlated, then you get no benefit, and they don't even need to be statistically correlated. All it takes is one simultaneous peak, and you're out of luck. For example, a business that sold flowers and did tax returns turns out not to be able to self-multiplex because Valentine's Day and early filer peaks come at the same time. So there can be surprises as to when peaks arrive. There are also behavioral economic effects, which I'll touch upon. So I don't have time to go into all of these, but I love all of this behavioral economics, human psychology, neuroeconomics. And the point is that various of these cognitive anomalies either are good for the cloud or good for enterprise data centers. Just to cover two, the need for control really favors your data center because you can control everything. Now, you may be paying extra for that, but at least you can control everything. On the other hand, the human brain treats zero price very uniquely and gives it sort of more benefit than it deserves. So, for example, in a classic experiment, customers would rather have a free $10 coupon than spend $7 for a $20 coupon, even though spending $7 for a $20 coupon is a $13 benefit, which is larger than getting a free $10 coupon. So there's a lot of these, and they can impact human decisions as to which way to go in various ways, in addition to the more rational analytics like performance and security. So I think I proved that hybrids are probably best if you assume that you have a well-run enterprise. And so there's a lot of different hybrids and some additional factors that are relevant. Let me just build out some examples. The upper left is a simple one, and it's things like content delivery, where basically I don't need much coordination between the enterprise and the cloud. So I can pre-position things like content, like PowerPoints, both in a content delivery network and in my data center, and I don't have to worry very much about data integration. Another type of hybrid, which is a popular use of the cloud, is business continuity and disaster recovery. And there the idea is that my computing is done in the enterprise, but I use the cloud for backup. So I might use combinations of cloud and co-location space, where I synchronously mirror into colo space with direct connect to a cloud and therefore can rapidly recover operations if need be, or I can take snapshots and throw them into the cloud, and that provides a degree of continuity. Content delivery is a great example of where the cloud acts as the front end, or delivering edge services is another example of that, shopping carts and so forth, even though I may use the enterprise data center for my database of record and the ultimate repository for financial transactions. And then there are more complex scenarios that require realistically a little bit more effort, and the industry is emerging there. This is, I think, the ideal story is complete, easy fungibility, where I can kind of go back and forth between the cloud and the enterprise at will, based on cost differences, performance optimization, real-time electricity prices, and so forth. Now, people don't really talk about, when they use the term hybrids, they don't really mean this, but in my mind, it's kind of an example of a hybrid architecture, which is instead of hybrids in space, hybrids in time. And kind of examples that come to mind are doing your development within your own data center, but then moving it to the cloud when you need to actually scale. Or you could imagine the reverse in the upper right, migrating to the cloud, as many companies are doing with applications, and in fact their entire data center strategy in some cases. And then there's also migration from the cloud, where some companies, most recently Evernote is one, move from the cloud to the enterprise data center. And one of the key things that I should mention is the importance of performance. It isn't just unit cost. You've got to make sure you're comparing to apples to apples. So what some companies have found is by moving out of maybe one size fits all is a little bit of a stretch. So maybe it's, you know, the 500 sizes that are available fit all. If you've got some unique characteristics to your application that requires more of a custom architecture and unshared resources, then it turns out that even if the cloud is cheaper, it still may make sense to move in because you'll get a performance lift. And some companies have seen 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 type of performance acceleration. So that means that, in effect, the cloud would have to be 4 times cheaper. And again, the spikiness is important as well for the cloud to make sense. So, you know, I think when you think about all of this stuff, it really comes down to there are kind of a lot of options that you may want to have, and they include both solving today's problems and also maintaining flexibility to solve tomorrow's. As an example of kind of an interesting real-world application of this, there's an entertainment company that decided to keep sort of everything in their data center during periods of low demand, but when there's spiky demand, it isn't a complete true hybrid, but they basically activate sort of an on-demand content delivery network and more stat content like their catalog of music and movies and trailers and clips kind of just gets played in the cloud, but they keep their actual financial transactions very close to home in their enterprise data center. Now, there are a lot of things that companies can do to optimize their own workloads and sort of create flatter workloads, that eliminate that spikiness. The first thing is whenever you have individual variability, this, for example, shows a workload varying across time periods in accordance with a uniform distribution, you get some pretty wide variation, right? It could be, in this case, between 0 and 1 demand. You can think of it also as between 0 and 1 million users or 0 and 1 million CPUs or whatever metric you'd want to use. Now, if you had 50 such workloads and you were able to dynamically aggregate them together, you end up with this relative smoothing. And it turns out that mathematically, that smoothing is easy to see. It leads to a utilization benefit and therefore a relative performance benefit. So it follows an inverse square root law, which means that if you just multiplex 2 independent workloads, you know, and it's going to vary by industry, but let's say you're a diversified conglomerate that makes jet engines and does bank loans, obviously those are independent, then, you know, you'd end up with an immediate benefit of a 30% reduction in a penalty function simply by muxing two workloads together. Another tactic is having deferrable workloads where whenever the live workload is low, you run this deferrable or potentially discretionary task, and that gives you essentially flat utilization. You know, this isn't just an idle strategy. A good example is probably Microsoft, where, for example, if you just think about the Bing search engine, Bing gets variable usage during the day, maybe not so much in North America at 2 a.m. as at 2 p.m., and so they could use those same compute resources, for example, to crawl the web. So it's easy to backfill and therefore generate relatively flat load and achieve utilization and therefore deliver cost benefit. There are other factors that are worth considering. One is that if you're in a period of exponential growth, then any fixed provisioning interval, for example, this TP over here, looks like it stays the same regardless of how big the demand is, but that's not the important point. The important point is this vertical line, which shows the difference between demand and the ability to serve that demand. It turns out that that grows exponentially. In other words, with every day, you're exponentially worse off, and that's a strong argument for using the cloud. Another good example or good rationale for using the cloud is user experience, where for interactive workloads like website delivery, you would like to leverage a global cloud provider that has a presence in the major economic areas in which you're doing business. And you know, there's a lot of rules around that, but basically it's by having this kind of distributed presence that you can get down to 20 or 30 milliseconds of latency versus if you only have a single node through, say, one enterprise data center. Worst case, it's 160 to 180 milliseconds round-trip network delay. That may not sound like a lot, but the problem is that when you're loading a web page, you do multiple fetches, and therefore that tenfold reduction in latency can result in a page that loads in a few hundred milliseconds instead of a few seconds, and that turns out to be critical to user experience and thus revenue. So, kind of maybe to sum up a lot of this stuff, there are benefits to the private cloud, including things like control and optimal privacy. You know, the NSA perhaps is less likely to get in, though who knows. Possibly baseline cost. In other words, the unit cost to run baseline workloads. And then there are advantages to the public cloud in terms of elasticity to handle spikes and user experience for a global audience of interactive users. And those users are increasingly not just people, but also things. Doing computing with things requires even lower latencies than with people often. So you can think about, for example, connected vehicle collision detection. You can think about a construction site with moving cranes that needs to ensure that even with swaying due to wind, the cranes don't run into each other. You can think about traffic control systems. You can think about telesurgery. You know, the next generation of applications is going to be more thing-focused, and so latency will be even more relevant, meaning that either local processing and or distributed cloud resource processing will be important. But then there are also benefits to the hybrid, including, as I argued, unless you're you have a poorly run data center that's very costly, can include total cost advantages, can include some performance advantages. And by the way, that can cut both ways. For example, there's a company, D-Wave Systems, that builds quantum computers that has said that they're going to be offering quantum computing as a service. And so there, performance of applications that look like, say, the traveling salesman problem may very well be faster if run in the cloud than if you try and run them on your own resources. So, you know, basically, I think the mellow approach and the mathematically correct and also behavioral economically correct answer is to say that rather than the cloud is false and, you know, it doesn't work, which I don't think anyone believes anymore, but for a while people were getting a little agitated about it, or conversely to say that all IT has to move to the cloud because of economies of scale, I think it's better to say, just like most things like housing, like electricity, like transportation, including ground transportation and air transportation, it's kind of a mix of dedicated resources and on-demand resources at flat rates regardless of use, coupled with pay per use based on use, and that kind of leaves your options open. Now, saying all that is great, but there are a set of requirements that then are kind of relevant to enabling hybrid solutions to actually come true. You know, your cloud provider should have a global footprint if workload interactivity is at all essential for you. You don't want to have separate management capabilities or systems to be able to manage either. You want to have a single pane of glass that keeps everything on the up and up, where you can then migrate applications easily from on-premises to the cloud and vice versa. You want to have an identical stack because you don't want to have any issues that arise where suddenly applications break because of some, you know, driver or API or lack of a microservice. So you want to have all of that be identical. You ideally would like some intelligent cost optimization capability where the cloud sort of self-optimizes and all you know is that you're running your workload and you don't really care where it's being run. It figures out data gravity issues, it figures out real-time cost optimization, and so forth. You need to have some visibility into the cost of running the application and also obviously relative performance in case there's a difference, which there very well may be, as I mentioned. You like to have all the relevant tools. You need to have an infrastructure that seamlessly fuses data that's sitting in the enterprise data center and sitting in the cloud, because again, data can be what trips you up. It's easy to move data, although it can be costly, depending. It's often easy to move applications or VMs, although there can be issues there. It can be more challenging to move them both simultaneously back and forth cost optimally. And then the last thing you'd like, of course, is consistency, so you don't have to have two separate development teams that somehow are expected to coordinate in how you build and deploy applications in this kind of seamlessly fused infrastructure. So, you know, I will let you take this list of high-level requirements and figure out kind of, you know, what that means for vendor or provider selection. But, you know, that's the kinds of things that you'd want to look for. And I'm not sure that we're completely there yet as an industry, but I think we're getting closer and closer every day. Now, just to end with some examples, here's a fairly famous British fashion retailer. They've gone to a hybrid cloud architecture, and one of the main things they use the hybrid architecture for is to be able to archive data in the cloud, and then they also do manage their spikes through this kind of hybrid architecture. And, you know, I don't really consider virtualization to have much to do with cloud, which probably makes me a heretic. It's a nice thing and it helps enable the cloud, but You can have clouds without virtualization and virtualization without the cloud. But nevertheless, you often do find them together. And so this particular company did, first of all, achieve some cost savings through virtualization, which then in turn enabled them to move to this hybrid architecture. And then, you know, as pointed out through the economic optimization arguments, they have managed to achieve ongoing savings through elasticity to handle the usual kind of spikes that you see in retail when you launch a new product line, have a fashion show, when it's holiday gift-giving season, like Singles Day in China or, you know, November to December in the U.S. And so that's one example. Another clever example, I thought that this was kind of a little bit of a different use case for hybrid cloud, is a large airline that, again, started with virtualization and managed to increase the number of servers per administrator 20-fold. Then they went to a fully hybrid cloud architecture, but the way that the hybrid was used was actually to move workloads from the enterprise data center into the cloud, and then to move from the cloud into the enterprise data center, but the first data center was 1,000 miles away from the second data center. So by having this full hybrid uniform stack, et cetera, capability in place, they were able to then do these hybrids over time that included moving the application into the cloud and then relatively quickly thereafter moving it back into the enterprise data center. And, you know, they actually leveraged what looked like some of the BCDR tools that were built into their platform to be able to do that. And it was, you know, kind of didn't require any special data center migration feature. It just looked like a BCDR solution. And it turned out to, as you would expect, you know, dramatically reduce the types of resources that might otherwise have been required, because rather than replicating the resources that they could move from data center one to data center two, they just took, you know, the relevant physical hardware from their first site, and while the workloads were running in the cloud, they put it on a truck, shipped it over to the other site, plugged them in, and then were ready to go to accept the return of the application. So that's right on schedule, no coughing fits, which was good. You know, hopefully I've made you at least think about kind of whenever anyone just waves their hands and says, this is the right answer and that's the wrong answer and you got to trust me, this gives you some tools and checklists and things like that to think about kind of really what is the right answer for your business, which is probably going to be different for all of you on this call. So Nadav, I'll turn it back over to you, and maybe you can describe the process for asking questions, and then I'll try my best to answer them.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Joe, for joining us, first of all, especially with you feeling a little bit under the weather. We appreciate it. So if anybody has any questions, please feel free to type them into the Q&A widget you have at the bottom of your screen. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. We have a few that have already popped up during the presentation. So first question is, Adam would like to know, what are the key challenges related to determining what to keep on-prem versus bringing up to the cloud?
Well, I mean, I think I just spent a lot of time trying to go through that. So, you know, it's cost factors, performance, security, corporate strategy, for example. You know, there's a separate economic argument that rather than getting into Excel spreadsheets is one that says that if you're a company that is focused on making jet engines or let's say a Hollywood movie studio or what have you, then how much time do the executives really want to spend worrying about the fact that a particular data center is down or a network service provider has increased their costs or there's an outage due to this or that, which the team is taking a look at. You know, they just want to make movies. So there's that core versus context argument that says that maybe strategically the best thing to do is just move everything into the cloud and, you know, just we don't want to worry about it. And that's as valid an argument as any. You know, so I think maybe the key decisions to my mind are corporate strategy, the hard dollar costs, some of the human factors around things like development team motivation, which, you know, it's generally cool if you're able to work with the cloud and good for your resume. You know, I think increasingly it's even cooler to work with hybrid clouds. So, you know, there's the application performance characteristics. There's a degree of data gravity. You know, there's the 35 or so individual cost factors that I mentioned, like access to electricity, data center space, you know, whether equipment leases are coming up, your ability to hire the right security personnel yourself. So, you know, I think I could just kind of rattle them off for a long time. But I think the key thing to do is maybe just go back over the presentation.
Great. So we have another question from Rich. He wants to know, he says, a lot of the material covered seems to be geared towards enterprise-level businesses. Do the same concepts and reasoning apply to the small and mid-sized businesses as well when thinking about hybrid cloud scenarios?
You know, in general, I would say that the smaller you are, the more you should just be going for pure SaaS. And I mean, when I think about the smallest of SMBs, what I think about is a pizzeria. And, you know, what I like to say is it's hard to picture that, you know, the same guys that are tossing the dough up in the air are going to take a break, you know, go behind the pizza oven into their data center to run their, you know, to tune their servers, right? It's just, it's a competency that they don't have. And so, you know, there's a case where just, you know, there you should be going with pure cloud, and I would say, you know, not even just pure cloud is in, you know, infrastructure as a service. I would say skip infrastructure and platform. You don't have the competencies, right? You should be, you know, using, you know, email services and, you know, Office 365 as a relevant product, you know, for Microsoft and so forth, and Dynamics and those things, because it just doesn't make sense. So somewhere on that journey, you know, when you're no longer a single pizzeria, but you're, let's say, Domino's, and, you know, Domino's doesn't just make pizza. They have extremely sophisticated information technology. They massively use data. They use gamification. So each restaurant is told how they're doing in terms of how quickly they're fulfilling orders. You know, you can order online and have pizza tracked through GPS, which is something like Great Pizza Service, but then they're actually moving to GPS on both delivery bicycles and trucks, so you'll be able to see your pizza come to you. So there, when you think about, I don't know, tens of thousands of restaurants, you know, that each have a lot of IT, then you're no longer just the corner pizzeria, then you're a larger enterprise, and there it makes sense to think about, you know, these other issues that a larger enterprise should look at. But it's a good point. I should have mentioned that a lot of this is more the, you know, the well-run larger enterprise than either a poorly run large enterprise or, you know, a small business that really shouldn't be wasting time on this stuff.
Okay, so it looks like we're just about running out of time. Wanted to thank you again, everybody, for joining us for this hybrid cloud webinar with cloud thought leader Joe Weinman. If you're interested in additional information about hybrid cloud, you can find some more webinars about hybrid cloud in the resources widget. And you can also find Joe's white paper about hybrid cloud in there. You can also stay tuned for some additional cloud-related webinars that we will publish in the coming months. Like I mentioned in some of the Q&A for some of the people that asked, the presentation and the recording will be available. It will be sent to you via email. The presentation will be available for download in PDF format, and that'll be sent to you as soon as the archive will be ready. So thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.